Back in the 1970s, there was a Saturday Night Live sketch that featured a character that some of you might remember, a character that was called the Land Shark. The Land Shark. Now, the Land Shark was this big, lumbering, air-breathing shark, and it would come to the doors of the unsuspecting. It would knock on the doors and ask to be let in, in which case all sort of calamity would ensue. Now, in order to convince people to let him in, this Land Shark had to come up with some guys, some ideas, some words, some phrases that would entice the reticent to open the door. And so in order to convince people to open the door, the Land Shark would say that he was all manner of other things than what he was. He would say that he was a TV repairman. He would say he was a door-to-door salesman. He would say he was delivering a candy gram. Now, at first, people were skeptical. They'd hear this lumbering creature outside their door mumbling different things, and they would be skeptical about what would happen if they would open the door. But eventually, the Land Shark would say just the right thing. He'd say just the right thing that would entice them to do something that they know they shouldn't do. He would say something to them that would encourage them, entice them to do something that they shouldn't. He would convince them that he was nice and benign and harmless, and they would then open the door only to be swallowed alive by this giant foam shark's head that appeared on the screen. Now, in case people couldn't get enough of this skit, Saturday Night Live repeated it and had all manner of variations. I think people were starved for entertainment in the 70s, but they had this as a frequent occurrence, is one of the most popular. Now, with that said, in today's text, as I was looking at this text and thinking about Hezekiah opening his door to the Babylonians, this picture of the Land Shark kept coming to mind. This picture of Hezekiah, he knows this is a bad idea. He knows what has come knocking on the door of Judah, so to speak. He knows this is not a great plan. And yet, those on the outside say just the right thing. And he says, come on in. And the result is disastrous. See, just like the Land Shark, the Babylonians would show up saying all sorts of nice, benign things, but they had malevolent intentions. And in time, those intentions would find their fruition, or in time, Judah would be swallowed, so to speak, would be swallowed alive by the Babylonians. Now, before we return today's passage and work our way through it, let me explain or set up one of the things that we should extract from the text, one of the things that we can and should look for in today's text. There are, even today, even this week, things knocking at the door, so to speak, of our lives. Things looking to find a foothold in our hearts, in our homes, in the hearts of our loved ones, maybe our children. There's all manner of things outside the door looking to get in. And they will say all manner of benign statements, all sorts of sultry whispers will come to us that give us reasons to let things into our hearts, into our homes, into our lives that we ought not. Babylon, so to speak, is knocking at our door. Will we let them in? Will we let these influences in? Will we let those things that we ought not into our hearts and into our lives? And if we already have, because that may be true for many of us, maybe the problem is not what is outside the door looking to come in. Maybe this morning the problem is that it's already in. Maybe the problem is we already opened the door. Maybe Babylon's already in our hearts and our lives and the lives of our family. Then the issue is, what do we do now? If we're introspective enough to know we've let danger into our hearts, our lives, our families, our homes, then how do we respond? How do we evict the Land Shark? How do we evict Babylon, so to speak? Well, I hope we can bear these questions in mind as we look at the text, because the text is going to give us some idea of the danger that we are otherwise in, apart from God's help, apart from God's grace, in overcoming these sins, these temptations. Let's look now at verses 12 through 13 of our text, and then let's work our way through the balance. Verse 12. At that time, Berodach-Baladan, the son of Baladan, the king of Babylon, in other words, this is a prince, sent letters and a present to Hezekiah, for he had heard that Hezekiah had been sick. And Hezekiah was attentive to them. This is our first warning that something's going to go bad. Hezekiah was attentive to them, and he showed them all the house of his treasures, the silver, the gold, the spices, the precious ointments, and all his armory, which is interesting. All that was found among his treasures. There was nothing in his house or in all his dominion that Hezekiah did not show them. All right. At the outset of chapter 20, we have to understand that King Hezekiah had been ill. He had been sick. In fact, he had been dying. Now, Hezekiah, in general, is considered a pretty good king, a pretty good king of Israel. There were some good things that happened across his reign. And he grew ill later in life, and as I'm sure would be the case if you and I would grow ill, he prayed. He says, Dear God, I'm ill, I'm going to die, save me.
save.
Now, upon hearing this prayer, God, for reasons that were according to his good pleasure, God responded. God healed Hezekiah. God sent Isaiah to tell Hezekiah that he had heard his prayer. He had heard his prayer of desperation. And in fact, he was not only going to help Hezekiah to recover, but he was going to give him another 15 years, which at this stage of life was great. If you're Hezekiah, this is wonderful news. You've been sick, you've been on your deathbed, and now you've been given a reprieve. God has smiled upon you. He sent Isaiah, who everyone knows is the man of God. He sent Isaiah to come and to tell you that you got it. You got another 15 years. Now, if you're the king, you're excited. You're excited about that. One minute you're dead man walking, the next minute you're running the royal marathon. Things are looking good if you're Hezekiah here. But then, just as life is really picking up for Hezekiah, there's a knock, so to speak, on the door of his kingdom. Hezekiah had listened attentively. He would have heard some early century variation on the word candygram. Oh, in this case, it was a present. It was letters. It was gifts to this. Okay. The door of Judah had been knocked upon. On the other side was Babylon. On the other side was the Babylonian envoy. They brought letters and a present to Hezekiah. And because he was already having such a good time, he'd had such a good week, such a good year, things were going so well, he's beaming, he opens the door, he thinks all is right with the world. He welcomes in that which he ought not to welcome. He wasn't on his guard. He wasn't doing the thing kings should do and protect that which is in his kingdom. He says, come on in. And Scripture says then that he was attentive to them. It means he didn't just sit there and kind of harumph and let them on in and keep a watchful eye on them. What it means is he was attentive. He said, bring out the feast, bring out the food, let's provide, let's take care of our guests, let's do everything we can to make them feel at home, let's brush their hair, let's coddle them in every way imaginable. In fact, let's give them a tour. And this won't be a usual tour. Let's show them everything. Not a square inch of our kingdom. We will not show them. And that's what he did. In verse 13, we see that the king allowed the land shark, allowed the Babylonians to see everything he had. All the silver, all the gold, all the spices, all his armory, which again is very significant and gives us some sense as to what his real motivation was, which we'll talk about in a few moments. But for our purposes now, he showed them all that he had. Everything he had dominion of, which was a significant amount, he showed them. Now, why would he do this? Even to our untrained eye, none of us are kings or royal dignitaries or what have you, but even to our untrained eye, this doesn't seem like the swiftest of ideas. So why? Why would he do this? What possible reason could Hezekiah have had for these mind-blowing actions? Well, if you're wondering that, good news, you're in good company, because the prophet Isaiah wondered that too. Isaiah, he gets wind of this. And I don't know if there was a prophetic facepalm, but he had some sort of reaction. And so he comes to Hezekiah and he says, what? Well, what? He says, what happened? Let's look at verses 14 and 15. Then Isaiah the prophet went to King Hezekiah and said to him, what? What did these men say? Where did they come from to you? And Hezekiah said, they came from a far country. They came from Babylon. And Isaiah said, what have they seen in your house? And Hezekiah answered and said, they have seen all. And that's probably where the facepalm kicked in. They have seen all that is in my house. There is nothing among all my treasures that I have not shown them. All right. So Isaiah hears about the Babylonian's visit. He already knew the answers to the questions before he asked it. I think he was waiting to see kind of how Hezekiah would respond. So he asked the king, what happened? What's the deal? Now, to his credit, Hezekiah tells him what happened. He tells him the truth. He doesn't hold back. Which gives you a sense that he didn't totally understand that what he was doing was that bad or that wrong. He just says, well, hey, they came. I showed them around. I showed them all that I had. Now, again, Isaiah is trying to figure out the motivation here. And I think the more he hears, the more he understands this is not a good motivation. So for our purposes, why do we think Hezekiah did it on the basis of what we see in this passage? Well, there's a few possibilities that scholars have considered. There's a few ideas that scholars have thought about as to why Hezekiah might have done this. And one of the default ideas is that Hezekiah was a proud man, and that what he did was born out of his pride. He had riches. He had wealth. He had just been healed. God was listening to him. He thought, I'm the king. The people show up, and he wants to show off. He shows them everything. He shows them all he's got. There's a guy I knew just out of college who bought a new car. He put every penny he had, every penny he didn't have, into this vehicle. And I've never really been a car guy. I mean, I like to drive them, but I don't really understand all the bells and whistles and everything that's under the hood and so forth. But this guy, he took pride in me. He lifted the hood and he showed me every square inch of this vehicle. And it was impressive. I mean, again, I didn't really know what I was looking at, but it was impressive. He shows me everything. And the reason he showed me everything is because he was very proud of it. He was very proud of it. Some theologians think that what's happening here is that Hezekiah, this was an issue of ego. He wanted to demonstrate to the Babylonians that he was a man who was well-to-do and well-loved by his own. Now, I think that's probably part of what was going on. I think it's certainly possible. I mean, kings have egos. So it's very probable that Hezekiah had some pride in this, and that's part of the reason he did this. But I think that's not the whole story. I think that's not the only reason he did what he did. I think one of his primary motivations was not just his pride, but I think what he did was born out of strategy. I think what he did was strategic to some extent. Now, not necessarily good strategy, but it was strategy all the same. See, the kingdoms of Hezekiah's day, they were big on alliances, which makes sense because if you study the years of yore, study times of antiquity, what you know is that kingdoms are always overtaking other kingdoms. The history of humanity, especially in this era, was of small kingdoms being taken over by larger kingdoms and the like. And so it was natural, whether you're a king of something small or great, to seek out alliances, to seek out relationships with other nations. Given how many were struggling for world domination at the time, it made some sense to have alliances for mutual defense and protection. Now, in recent years leading up to today's text, Judah had won some significant battles. Now, one of those battles had been against the Assyrians, and that probably gave the Babylonians a great impression of Judah because the Assyrians were no one to be messed with. They thought, in all likelihood, that Judah would make for a great ally, and that's probably why they showed up at the door. Now, in order to confirm that opinion, you know, sometimes when people think well of us, we try to live up to that expectation. When someone has an idea that we're something wonderful, something sharp, we try to be just as sharp as they think we are. Well, that may well be what Hezekiah does here. They show up and they think that he's great and they think that he's strong and the like, and he plays into that. So he shows them all that he's got. He shows them his wealth. And he tries to convince them, if they need convincing, what a great ally he would be. And part of the reason we know that this was strategic and he was trying to demonstrate what a great ally he would be is because he didn't just show them his dollarama. He didn't just show him around the palace. He didn't just show him, you know, the wealth and the spices, but he showed them his armor. He wanted them to understand that they would be a potent ally if the need were to arise. Now, as we think that through, we might have trouble identifying the sin. Because alliances, I mean, you know, make some sense. Alliances, especially in this age, it seemed fairly reasonable. Who wants to face the enemies of the world alone? So why was this a problem? Well, the problem with Judah's alliances, whether it was Babylon or anybody else, was twofold. First of all, worldly alliances brought with them worldly influences. Worldly alliances brought with them worldly influences. Years earlier, you remember King Solomon. King Solomon had wealth and fame and riches and power. I mean, he had the pinnacle of everything you can have. Everything you can have, everything you can be, the wisdom, the power, the fame, the money. He had all this stuff. And yet, in spite of being very wise, he didn't always act accordingly. And one of the things he did was he married the daughter of Pharaoh. Solomon married the daughter of Pharaoh, which is absolutely an issue of strategy, of forming alliances and the like. But here's the thing. Solomon didn't settle on just the daughter of Pharaoh. Those who know the story of Solomon know that he ended a lot worse than he started. They know that the story of Solomon is one where he married hundreds of wives from foreign pagan nations. Hundreds of wives and concubines and the like. And one of the reasons that he did so was in order to establish diplomatic ties with these other countries. However, one of the inevitable results of those marriages, of bringing the daughter of Pharaoh into your home, into your bed, and all the other wives and the like from all these other nations, one of the predictable, inevitable outcomes of those marriages was that all sorts of foreign, pagan belief systems infiltrated it, came on in to Israel. Before you knew it, there was all sorts of shrines and high places set up to foreign, pagan gods. Whether you're talking about Solomon, which is one easy example, or we're talking about you or I, you cannot ally yourself with the ungodly and think that that will make you more righteous. You cannot ally yourself with a host of worldly beliefs or priorities, cultural norms, people. You cannot ally yourself with these things without having these beliefs or priorities or norms or people affect and stain your witness. You cannot do it. In any case, that is one, probably several reasons why it was a bad idea for Hezekiah to try to impress Babylon. Was that by having a close relationship with Babylon, the beliefs of Babylon would continue to influence God's people. Now, the second reason that this was such a bad idea is because God had told his people that they did not need the foreign pagan nations to come to their side. God had regularly, consistently told his people in the Old Testament that their trust was in who? God. Their trust was in God. God, God, God. Not in the flesh, not in man, not in Egypt, not in Babylon. Not in all the things and the swords and the armament and the horses and the chariots of the world combined. Their trust was to be in him alone. And he had made this clear from one end of the Old Testament right to the other. One end of the Bible to the other. This is not hidden in the dust jacket. This is not a surprise, a gotcha moment. God said, don't trust in the flesh. Trust in me. Listen to what God said in Exodus 34. Obey what I command you today. I will drive out before you the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, the Jebusites. Be careful not to make a treaty with them. Be careful not to make a treaty with those who live in the land where you're going, or they will be a snare to you. This is what we said earlier. You make ungodly relationships and alliances, they cannot help but to trip you up. You want some practical application? Again, the same is true for you and I. You and I might not be making relationships or treaties with the Pharaoh or Babylon or what have you. There's all manner of other things and influences that we're allowing in the door of our life. Now, God said roughly the same thing, roughly the same warning in Psalm 118. He said, it's better to trust in the Lord than to put confidence in man. It's better to trust in the Lord than to put confidence in princes. Guess who it was that had sent these envoys? Prince of Babylon. You see, if the reason that Hezekiah was so welcoming to the Babylonians was because he wanted to form an alliance relationship with them, this was in direct violation of what God had consistently told people, told the king, told the leaders, through the prophets. He said, don't do it. That's exactly what Hezekiah appears to be doing here. Time and time again, God had demonstrated that he alone could protect his people. That even if the people in Israel didn't have a single sword among them, that God could contend with the greatest of armies. And to prove that point is true, if you were to look back just a few paragraphs earlier, you would find that God had sent an angel to slay upwards of 100,000 Assyrians in their sleep. God had done it. God does not rely on Pharaoh, on Egypt, on Babylon, on the Hittites, the Jebusites, the Canaanites, any of these things. He does not rely on power, on sword, on muscles, on any of that. For he can do all things apart from this. What he calls us to is trust, faith. Hezekiah at times, had that manner of faith. He did not hear. He did not hear, and it would come at a cost. Let's listen to Isaiah's rebuke of Hezekiah in verses 16 through 19 now. Then Isaiah said to Hezekiah, hear the word of the Lord. Behold, the days are coming when all that is in your house and what your fathers have accumulated until this day shall be carried to Babylon. Nothing shall be left, says the Lord. And they shall take away some of your sons who will descend from you, whom you will beget. And they shall be eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon. That is a direct, direct arrow to Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. But keep that in mind a week from now. They shall take away some of your sons who will descend from you, who you'll beget. They shall be eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon. So Hezekiah said to Isaiah, and this is fascinating. There's any manner of responses he could have had, but listen to what he says. He says, the word of the Lord which you have spoken is good. For he said, will there not be peace and truth, at least in my day? If my people trust the Babylonians so much, then we'll see how much they trust them, how they like them. After they've been enslaved by them, after they've been oppressed by them. Know this, the things that tempt you, if you give in to it, will enslave you. The things that tempt you, A sin crouching at your door. Remember this picture from Genesis? The land shark knocking, the Babylonians right there. These things, when you give in to them, when you give in to sin and temptation, they will enslave you. You will not be their master. It will be the reverse. This is the hard lesson that God's people were to learn as a result of this action. When King Hezekiah was tempted to trust the prince of Babylon, he was putting the nation on a path that would end badly, badly for them all. And even though the outcome would take upwards of 100 years, the king's decision to show Babylon the wealth of Judah and the inclination he had to seek out an adulterous relationship with this pagan nation and their pagan gods, it would cost Judah dearly. Behold, the days are coming when all that is in your house shall be carried to Babylon. You showed them everything, well, guess what's going to happen? Everything is going with them. In God's time, everything's going to be going with them. But it's going to take time. Now, Hezekiah, in that moment, his reaction is this. Well, he says, well, that's no good. But, and then he seeks the silver lining, because we all do. He seeks the silver lining. He says, kind of bad that everything's going to go, but at least it won't happen on my watch. And my days are going to be peace. Really, nothing's going to change in my day-to-day life. So you know what? I guess that's fine then. God's going to do what God's going to do. And that's the response. And that, for any of us, it should kind of blow our minds. How could he be so indifferent? Now, scholars have tried to interpret what he means in a lot of different ways. But it all comes back to some form of indifference towards the future, to some sort of careless and reckless action, no matter what the cost would be. That is at the heart of sin. This week, when you're tempted to do something you ought not to do, part of that temptation is to think that in this moment, in the here and now, I can have something I want. I could do something I want. I could experience something. And in the moment, I'll enjoy it. I'll benefit from it. What happens? And then we think, if there are consequences, they'll be down the road. If they come at all, they'll be down the road. That's the siren song of sin, to suggest that you can and should have what you want when you want it, and if there are consequences, maybe they won't be that bad, maybe they'll never come. And so we pursue these things. Now, we don't know all that was going on in Hezekiah's mind here, but some variation of that was probably at hand. Whatever the case, he clearly had a selfish outlook. We can certainly conclude that. He had a selfish outlook. And another way that we know he had a selfish outlook is look at the job he did raising up the next king, the next one who would lead. Look at the job he did. Let's look at our remaining verses, verses 20 through 21 now, as we consider the selfish mentality of Hezekiah. Verse 20. Now the rest of the acts of Hezekiah, all his might and how he made a pool and a tunnel that brought water into the city, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the king of Judah? So Hezekiah rested with his fathers, and then, bum, 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 Manasseh. And then Manasseh, his son, reigned in his place. As we said earlier, at one point Hezekiah had been dying, but God heard his prayer and gave him another 15 years. When those 15 years ended, on a dime, Hezekiah, he died then and there, he rested with his fathers. Unfortunately, a nasty, vile, 12-year-old boy named Manasseh claimed the throne at that time. And as you can read, if you were to look in 2 Chronicles 33, for the first number of years in Manasseh's reign, it was like the kid from The Omen. He was terrible. He was dreadful. Listen to what 2 Chronicles 33 says. It says that Manasseh practiced soothsaying. He used witchcraft. He used sorcery. He consulted mediums and spiritists. He did much evil in the sight of the Lord to provoke the Lord to anger. If you're a parent in the room this morning, then know this. No matter how advanced you may get in your profession, in your vocation, no matter how many plaudits the world might heap at your door, no matter how well things might go in your vocation, if you do not invest yourself in the spiritual formation of your children, you're dropping the ball. Dropping the ball on one of the greatest legacies you have. The legacy is not how marvelous you are at your vocation or your hobbies or your pursuits. The greatest legacy you have is your children. And their spiritual formation, God has placed it in your hands. God placed the spiritual formation of Manasseh in the hands of King Hezekiah. How did he do? Well, we can only judge it based on the fruit, and the fruit is bad. Manasseh, he went sideways all manner of things. He went backwards in all manner of things. Hezekiah had been at the pinnacle of worldly fortunes and success, but the trappings of his vocation evidently neutered his paternal instincts, and he dropped the ball in raising his son. Now, there's more we could say about that. And for the remaining moments, I want to tie the events that we've just discussed, the events of Hezekiah and Babylon and the like, I want to tie it to our study. It's going to begin next week in the book of Daniel. Now, next week, when we open our Bibles to Daniel chapter 1, the very first verse is going to say this. It's going to say, in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, the king of Judah, into his hand. The fulfillment of the prophecy, the fulfillment of the words of Isaiah, would come true in the time of Daniel. To understand Daniel, you need to understand the decision that led to Nebuchadnezzar coming in. The book of Daniel describes the fulfillment, the outworking of Hezekiah's decision and Isaiah's prophecy. Now, although I'm tempted to just dive into that narrative right now, let me ask you a question as we close. In your own life, I imagine that it's unlikely that the actual Babylonians are going to come to your door. In your own life, I imagine it's unlikely that Babylon itself is going to come knocking, and if that should happen, then something has gone dreadfully wrong somewhere. However, the sins and dangers that Babylon has always represented, Babylon is always, you know, equal sign, sin, danger, bad stuff. That which Babylon has always represented, dangerous alliances with dangerous people, ungodly people, ungodly worldviews. Even if Babylon itself should not send envoys to your door this week, that which Babylon typified will not only be at your door, it'll be on your cell phone, it will be in your computer, it will be in your ears, in the media, in the culture all around you. We are immersed in it. We are immersed in Babylon. The question is, again, how are we responding? What alliances are we forging? Not caring what we do and the danger and the cost that comes with it. How many ungodly alliances and influences have you already let in? Let in through your door, maybe into your family life. How many people or things have you trusted with your future while giving your God lip service? How many candy grams have you willingly opened the door for only to invite sin and danger inside? King Hezekiah, he had one job, one primary job. King Hezekiah had one primary job, and that was to protect his kingdom. That's what kings do. And that meant keeping enemies out, not welcoming them in. The same is true for you and I. You who are fathers and mothers, you who are parents, you who are spouses, you who are bosses, leaders, elders, deacons, what have you. You have a job. Keep the enemies out. If you're a parent or leader in your home or business, if you're responsible for the well-being of others, if you're responsible for the local church, you cannot afford to sleep on these things. And so one way that we can respond to today's text is to be introspective for a moment and to ask ourselves, what is knocking at the doors of our hearts this week? And how resolute are we in our response? How resolute are we in shutting that door, keeping sin at bay? This morning, God's placed a lot in our hands. We have a lot we're accountable for. This means that we need to be introspective about these things and take the action that Hezekiah should have taken. Let me pray for us.
If you'd like to check out additional recordings or videos by Dr. Toby Holt, please visit our website at fpcgulfport.org. And if you're on the Gulf Coast, come join us at 11 a.m. Sundays at First Presbyterian Church of Gulfport, Mississippi.